Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about a new acquisition for the University of Tulsa's McFarland Library Special Collections, one that's been called one of the most handsome illustrated books of the 20th century. We'll also get a lesson on connoisseurship and handmade books with the McFarland Dean of the Library, Adrian Alexander. The library recently acquired The Four Gospels, a 1931 book created by British sculptor, illustrator, printmaker, and typographer Eric Gill for Golden Cockerel Press. One of only 488 copies in existence, the book is considered one of Gill's greatest works as an illustrator, with a design style that at once looks back to the work of medieval scribes and forward to Art Deco modernism of the 1930s. For the book, Gill created the Golden Cockerel font. In fact, chances are if you check your computer's font list, you'll find at least two of Gill's creations on it, Gill Sans and Perpetua. Alexander joins us today to talk about the importance of this book for the Special Collections, why it's important for scholarship and connoisseurship. Adrian Alexander, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
This book of the Four Gospels, which was designed and illustrated by Eric Gill, has been called one of the 20th century's most handsome illustrated books. Now, why is that so?
Well, there are a few reasons, and to put those in context, I want to take you back a couple of decades or so before 1931 when this particular book was published. It really begins in the late 19th century with the arts and crafts movement. And a man named William Morris, who a lot of people know as one of the leaders of the arts and crafts movement, who was mostly known as an illustrator, as a textile designer, he became interested when he attended the first arts and crafts exhibition in 1888 in London in typography after he heard a lecture by a printer named Emory Walker. And Emory Walker's name keeps reoccurring throughout this whole story of the development of fine press work in England during that period. He was intimately involved with three of the greatest private presses that came along during the period of the 1890s, early 1900s.
Now, was fine press always a part of publishing, or had it disappeared?
It had disappeared, really. Morris had in mind, quite literally, another renaissance, if you will, of typography and book design, harkening back to the time of Aldus Manutius and Nicholas Jensen in Venice, because printing had become much more commercialized, especially in the 19th
century. I
would think
that fine printing, the history is probably tied to the aristocracy. You have this rise of the middle class. All of a sudden, we don't need this anymore.
We don't, and it becomes mass-produced. The paper becomes cheaper. The ink is shoddy. It runs. There's not as much attention to type design and how a book is laid out as there had been during that Renaissance period. So much of what Morris and others who were influenced by him wanted to do was reintroduce arts and crafts and the idea of artistic design, as well as having something interesting to read. So you find within that period of maybe 10 to 15 years, starting with Morris's The Kelmscott Press in 1891, you find some very ornately illustrated books, such as Kelmscott produced, with a lot of beautiful and sumptuous floriated borders and woodcut illustrations by Edward Burne-Jones and people like that, to something like the Dove's Press Bible that was published in 1903 that is very spare and simplistic. It's just the type font. It's all black, with the exception of the first letter of In the Beginning, which is in red, and the I extends all the way down the left margin of the page. So you saw a lot of variations to what people were doing, but the basic principles were we will pay attention to design, we will use fonts that are attractive to the eye.
Or new.
Or new in many cases. Yeah, uh-huh. All of Morris's were new. The Dove's type was new, designed by Emory Walker again. The Subiaco type at Ashendene Press at the same time was a new font. And as we'll see when we talk in a minute about the Golden Cockerel Press, that was a new font that Eric Gill ended up designing.
Now, listen, this Renaissance, was it really designed towards the aristocracy again, or was it catering to a new moneyed middle class?
It was a little of both. These were considered private presses, and they were usually done a small print run. usually for friends, but they were offered for sale.
Or connoisseurs, yeah.
Collectors, mm-hmm. and bibliophiles. And certainly in late Victorian England, there were certainly many people like that who had the means to collect, who had made great fortunes during the rise of the empire, and could afford nice, sumptuous libraries with beautifully bound and beautifully designed and illustrated books. So while the ultimate goal was not printing for profit, they were able to take care of themselves financially. Ashendene Press, which published from about 1895 or so until, well into the 1930s, paid for itself pretty much all the way along because there were enough collectors out there who were interested in this kind of beautiful book design.
Now, this book is Golden Cockerel mm-hmm. Press, which is 1931, as you mentioned.
Right.
And so this is well after that mm-hmm. revival began around yes. the turn of the century mm-hmm. or 1890s. Yep. And so this has been going, and it's starting to reflect modernism and all sorts of things. And this is where Eric Gill comes in. Eric, tell us a little bit about Eric Gill.
Well, Gill was primarily a sculptor at the time, born in 1882, I believe. Trained primarily as a sculptor, worked in stone principally. He was also a painter and did some other artistic things. But in, I think, about 1914, he met the great typographer Stanley Morrison, who designed the famous Times Roman font for the London Times newspaper, and became interested in typography. He was also an illustrator and did woodcut illustrations, and that is how he became associated with the second owner of Golden Cockerel Press. Golden Cockerel was founded in 1920, by a man named Harold Taylor, who really knew nothing about printing but had family funds and was interested in, had been exposed to some of these earlier fine press books, was interested in dabbling, if you will, in that sort of work, started up a press, hired some professional compositors and printmen to help him with that, and unfortunately, he died a few years after that, but Robert Gibbings, who bought the company from him, was an illustrator who became associated with the press and who knew Eric Gill and others and brought a number of really fine illustrators into what was really the best period of Golden Cockerel's existence, which was from about 1924 until the mid-1930s or so. Gill became really the principal illustrator, if you will. He was the only illustrator for both the four Gospels, and then just before that, between, I'd say about 1929 and 31, they produced a four-volume version of the Canterbury Tales, and Gill did all of the illustrations.
Which I understand was a little bit risque for the
day. It was a little risque, and that was one of the things. In fact, there were several books that they published at that time in which Gill was involved. They did a beautiful version of the Song of Songs that was extremely risque, but they could hang their hat on the fact that they were a, quote, private press. They were not a commercial publisher or a bookseller. They were doing
this. Gentlemen's libraries.
And a few into the British Library and other libraries. They could get away with some things as a result of that, and Gill had an interest in that and created beautiful, beautiful work. And as I said, he also was interested in typography, starting with his association with Morrison. He designed several types not long after Morrison. I believe it was
And when you go to your font file on your own computer, mm-hmm. you will see Gill Sans.
And Gill Sans is my favorite type on it. I use it in my emails all the time.
Yeah, Gill Sans, and then Perpetua is another one.
Perpetua was another one he designed in 1925, and there were several others as well.
And in fact, he designed the Golden Cockerel mm-hmm. for this particular
exactly.
book.
Exactly, and it had been used. Actually, there was one book that was published the same mm-hmm. year. It was an A.E. Copper novel, The Hundredth Story, that actually beat for Gospels to the punch, as it were. But the book that really established it as a well-known and beautiful font was the Four Gospels, and it's the first book that Gill did both as the illustrator and as the type designer.
Now, was it an extremely collectible book at the time of its publication, or is it only in hindsight as people really begin to appreciate it that it's this very beautiful book of the 20th century?
My understanding is that it was well-received because of the nature of it and the subject matter, and also because the illustrations were just so beautiful that it sold very quickly. There were 488 print copies and 12 in vellum for a run of 500. I think it sold fairly well from what I understand. Many collectors bought it. Some libraries bought it. it was out into the marketplace fairly quickly, and it has circulated in all of these copies. I actually communicated with a gentleman right after we announced our acquisition. He's a investment banker in Hong Kong, and he wanted to know which number our copy was. And I said, well, it's number 129. Why do you ask? And he said, I have had an interest in this book for years. I happen to own both a vellum copy and a print copy, and I am trying to establish, in the same way that a couple of people are keeping track of all the Kelmscott Chaucers in existence and where they are now, he's trying to do the same thing with the four Gospels. And he wanted to know where we got ours from the bookseller.
He's determining the book's provenance.
Yes, he's
basically
really establishing the provenance. He is so taken with this great example of mid-20th century printing and book design that he really wants to track each copy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book, because the book is the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the illustrations themselves, I'd say they have a sort of neoclassical look, except it's more like neo-medieval, because it really goes back to those ancient elongated figures that you would see in a medieval...
In an illuminated manuscript,
exactly. Yeah, right, a sort of scribe.
Yes, which was all hand-lettered, of course, by the monks. And they created some beautiful, beautiful work. And in many ways, both the work that William Morris did with the Kelmscott Press and certainly what Eric Gill did was a tribute to that beautiful artistic work that the monks did with their illuminated manuscripts, both in the initial letters, in the other illustrations, in the Golden Cockerel Canterbury Tales. You will see a lot of illustrations of different characters that are people that are suddenly peeking from the borders and looking, watching the story, or they're commenting across the story to one another. And there were examples of that even in medieval times. Monks, it was tedious work, and they spent hours and hours and hours in doing this. And to break some of the tedium, I think they
made a little joke.
They made some little jokes and had indulged in some whimsy. And there's certainly whimsy in the Canterbury Tales, and there's a bit of whimsy in the four Gospels as well. And
it's interesting, the line about the cock will crow thrice. Mm-hmm. There's just a slightly larger capital letter, and then there's a cockerel, basically,
yes, exactly.
Which goes along with the press name, too.
Yes,
so
yes.
Basically, getting ready to crow.
Yes, and there's even a reference I've read in one source that in one of the illustrations, I believe it's the one in Mark that you looked at of the birthday dinner of King Herod. And the young woman.
Oh, yes, Herodias.
Herodias is, and the daughter is dancing very fancifully through the A of the first word and in the line. And then the table is based on the N and the D. But one of the characters sitting at the table, I think playing Herod, looks a lot like Robert Gibbings, the owner of the Golden Cockerel Press. So Gill was always looking for ways to inject a little bit of whimsy and lightheartedness into it. But at the same time, he was a devout Roman Catholic by that time and was extremely serious about projecting and portraying the real power of the Gospels, and many of the illustrations in that do that as well.
What is really interesting, because a lot of the illustrations go with like the first word of a chapter,
yes,
or first word. And that's the interesting other thing is you're used to seeing a Bible with chapter numbers and verses. There's no chapter numbers or verses, just a few illustrations for the beginning of chapters.
And the verses are broken up throughout the body of the text with a small little printer's device. It's almost like a little star or something. One critic, one bibliophile who reviewed it, said that the one thing that bothered him about it, and he is one of the biggest fans in the trade, I guess you could say, of the book, but he said the one thing that bothers me is those little stars or buttons in there. He didn't care for those. But rather than break it up with lines and with margins to create the verses, it's just a steady flow of text with those few little breaks in between. But that really forces the eye to go to those beautifully illustrated first initials and really spend some time looking at those and see how he integrates them into the story, really. They're not just there as ornamentation. They really are a fundamental part of the story and how it's told.
When you're telling the birth story in Luke, you see the three magi, the shepherds there in the chapter titles. And there's also wonderful use of text, of using this font.
Yes.
When the Sermon on the Mount comes along, it's like he really sets that apart as probably, in his view, the essential teachings of Jesus. And it's really interesting how he puts that all together.
Yes.
But earlier I was talking about the figures, because the figures look somewhat like neo-medieval, but at the same time, they're absolutely modern. I mean, every once in a while you see a woman wearing a flapper dress.
Exactly, yes. he definitely placed it in two time periods. It's definitely designed and illustrated in the modern times. There's a lot of Art Deco to it, but at the same time, it's very medieval in other ways. And you'll see that in other books that Gill illustrated. He did much of the same
thing. And in fact, Art Deco is a big part of it because he was, as far as his sculpture goes, he was an Art Deco artist.
He was, indeed. Yes.
He did sculptures for a couple of hotels in England,
yes,
and as well as a number
Midland
of public
Hotel
buildings.
In Morecambe, he did a series of bas-reliefs for BBC's broadcasting house, in fact, in the 1930s in London, and then did some bas-reliefs in stone based on the creation of Adam for the League of Nations headquarters in Geneva later in the 30s, only a couple of years before he passed away in 1940, in fact.
Now, it's really interesting because Eric Gill is still known among graphic designers, mainly for his fonts,
yes,
I think, which are still in use. But
he's
has this very interesting checkered private life. Mm-hmm. He was, as you mentioned, he was a devout Roman Catholic, but his own private life was pretty strange and deviant. I mean, to the point, like, if he was doing this today, he'd be in prison for 300 years.
Indeed. Indeed. He would have...
He ritually abused his children?
Yes. It's the 1989 biography by Fiona McCarthy provides some of the first... Well, it was always suspected, I think, for a long time, but it was really documented through the use of diaries and letters.
Yeah, his diaries will spell this all out.
That he had intimate relations with his two eldest daughters, as well as a sister, over a long-standing period of time. He had many of his sculptures and drawings that are locked away in the vault of the British Library are very sexually explicit. His fascination with the human form, particularly with genitalia, is quite well established in some of his work. It's not out in public view in many cases, But again, if you look at some of the illustrations in a few of the Golden Cockerel books, you'll see some inkling of that kind of interest that he had. But and then in A.S. Byatt's great novel, there is a character who is a potter in this case named Flood, who has a large family, with him at his shop in down near Kent, and that character is generally recognized to have been patterned after Eric Gill.
My guest today is Adrian Alexander, the dean of the McFarland Library. The McFarland Library Special Collections have acquired a copy of what's been called one of the most handsome illustrated books of the 20th century, The Four Gospels, which was designed and illustrated by British sculptor and graphic designer Eric Gill, who also, as we mentioned, had this very strange and deviant private life, which came out about 45, 50 years after his death.
Mm-hmm.
How have those revelations affected his reputation? Is it because I know there's still an Eric Gill Society.
There is an Eric Gill Society that I think is very strong, has a strong presence on the web. I believe they have regular meetings. As an artist, I think he's still highly regarded. I've run across a couple of blogs that have had postings devoted to this whole issue of how do we treat a renowned artist like this in light of what we know now about
with a reprehensible private life. Mm-hmm.
And I think the BBC News, I think, did a report a year or two back on the same thing. But his art is everywhere, certainly in public spaces. That he designed the sculptures, the Stations of the Cross in Westminster Cathedral are Eric Gill pieces. Mm-hmm. And he did Stations of the Cross in at least two other churches that I've found references to. So I think in many ways it's an interesting dichotomy for him, because clearly he was a man of intense faith. His faith was his own interpretation, I guess you could say, but he was very, very, very devout in his own way, and he expressed that through some very beautiful art that he did with religious themes. The Four Gospels is one example of that, but his sculptures in churches and in other buildings are other examples of that. So it's a very interesting and complicated paradox, I guess, and people will always have a view about it and should. It's a topic that should be discussed, but the art is there and speaks for itself in many ways, I think.
Why is it important for a university to own a book like this? How will it be used? What's the reason for acquiring a book like this?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Libraries, both academic and public libraries, I think have, as part of their mission, a responsibility to preserve the past in some form or the other, as do museums and other cultural institutions. Books are an important and legitimate expression of our past, regardless of the subject area. Not all books that an academic library collects will be books that necessarily are meant to be circulated and out to the public. Some of them, they're too expensive and rare, and this is one of those examples where we wouldn't let it out of the building or even out of special collections. But it can be used for, I think, on the TU campus, a couple of things. Professor Teresa Valero in the School of Art has long had an outstanding graphic design program here, and one of the things that students learn in that program is book design. We have a very active program over there as part of that curriculum, in fact, where students learn to design books. And we love to see examples of their work and often put them on display. So we want to find teaching tools, and we buy other artists' books. Some of them are very unique. We have a dealer that comes by to see us about once a year with new examples of artists' books, and we try to devote a few of our funds to doing that.
And we should mention that this Four Gospels, it's handmade paper, hand-bound. Mm-hmm. So I had the opportunity mm-hmm. to actually hold this with mm-hmm. Plastic gloves, yes. and the pages are, you know, they're rough on the mm-hmm. edges.
Yes.
It's obviously this is a handmade
yes.
book.
It's very sumptuous paper. It's one of the hallmarks of this sort of fine printing is, and this again harkens back to the 19th century when paper became so widely used by then, of course, in commercial printing of all types, that there were new ways of producing paper that had a lot of less cotton rag content and more wood content and chemicals and things like that. And it didn't have nearly the quality and wouldn't last as long as some of these finer papers are. So the paper is typically made by an artisan. The ink, in many cases, is also made by an artisan who may be somewhere else. I think it was the Kelmscott Chaucer where Morris actually ended up going to Hanover, Germany, to find the right ink that he wanted for that particular work that would support, that would blend well with the paper, could still be clear on top of that beautiful paper, and would support the very intricate illustrations that he had. So the ink was equally important. It could not be overdone. And then designing exactly the right weight of font, the right thickness of the letters to go with the illustrations, all of that was an artistic endeavor. And these are great examples of how this form of art stands alongside other forms of arts and crafts at the time. So we have a responsibility, I think, in part to collect and preserve things like that so they can be seen by others later on. I think in the case of the Four Gospels, given the strong emphasis in our special collections on modernist literature, I think it holds a place there because of the people involved in it at a time when modernist literature was in its mm-hmm. heyday in the 20s and early 30s. So it represents a couple of different academic areas.
So that English, because you had Joyce and Rebecca West and all these early 20th century English writers.
A number of writers from that period. And then we have visual artists such as Gill who were interested. These presses were interested in producing beautiful editions of new literature as well as classic literature and expressing them in a way that hadn't been done in quite some time. So when you can find a good example, and we've got a few in our library, but not as many as others do. Well, we have a couple of Kelmscott pieces. We do have a Doves Press Bible, although it came to us in not very great shape, but we're trying our best to keep it alive, and so for anyone who wants to take a look at it. But these are there for people to come and use it as part of research. If they're doing a paper, say, on book design, or they want to do something on modernist literature, they can come to Special Collections and make use of that book.
And for your graphic artists, it's something that they can see at least facsimiles very easily, or maybe the original.
I think any graphic artist or designer who is really interested in learning something about what it takes to design really excellent type, and in this case one done by one of the greatest typographers of the 20th century. Here's an example that you can come and see up close, not just an image on a computer screen, but come and see the real thing. And obviously the difference is quite quite palpable in this case because I had looked at a number of illustrations of it before I got my hands on one of them. And it really does jump off the page. You can really, really tell the artistry that went into designing not only the type font but the illustrations as well.
Now, we alluded to this earlier, but how does this fit in within the collecting areas of special collections? I know you specialize in like a lot of early 20th century mm-hmm. writers, English writers. That's sort of the big mm-hmm. area of emphasis. But what are the areas this particular book fits in?
Our theology collection is not particularly strong. It's never, even though we are founded mm-hmm. by Presbyterians, we don't have a seminary, we do teach philosophy and religion. Again, it's a beautiful expression of the Gospels. Anyone who is interested in New Testament theology would find, the words haven't changed. It's the King James Version, basically, but there's just something about the way it's expressed on the printed page that will really maybe give you a different perspective on what the words mean. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a great example of what was going on during that modernist period in literature and other art forms. One of the great things about modernism is that you see this juxtaposition and intersection of art forms, whether it's painting or graphic design or woodcut illustrations or even motion pictures or whatever. There's a lot of synergy and convergence among these different art forms at the time that was very exciting to people. So this is another representation of that. And again, I think it's a great teaching tool for anyone interested in graphic design. So I think it supports those programs very well.
And now Special Collections is involved in a lot of different things. I mean, you own artworks, you own pottery, you own all sorts of things.
We have a little bit of everything.
And I know you just got a great collection of artwork that came
in. And as if we didn't already have a lot of art. In fact, we had an intern from TU's fairly new Museum Studies program work for us last year. As part of her internship, she cataloged over 600 pieces of art that we already had, including Lang and Bierstadt and Picasso and a few others along the way. But we did. We are in the process of inventorying now a large collection of paintings and prints and other works by the TU alumnus. Daniel Lang, who passed away last April and has left the bulk of his collection to TU and the Gilcrease and the Philbrook. And we got it out of New York last fall to get it down here and start processing it. And we have a lot of work still to do on it, but it's a huge collection of materials. We have a Lang hanging over in the Lorton Performance Center right now that President Upham picked out personally to hang over there when that building was dedicated. And we're going to have an even larger collection of Langs as well.
Well, let's hope we have a memorial retrospective.
I think that is probably in the works. I'm not sure of the timing of that, but there's a lot of interest across campus and a lot of people who are still here who remember Daniel Lang. And he came back. He was made an alumni member of our Phi Beta Kappa chapter a number of years ago and then was a distinguished alumnus in, I want to say, 2010. Mm-hmm. That was his last time, I think, to come back to campus, in fact. So a lot of people remember Daniel Lang and remember his work, and we will want to do something to honor that memory at some point in the future.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your time, Adrian. I appreciate it, and congratulations on this new Four Gospels.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Adrian Alexander is the McFarland Dean of McFarland Library at the University of Tulsa. The McFarland Library Special Collections recently acquired a 1931 copy of the Four Gospels, created by British sculptor, illustrator, printmaker, and typographer Eric Gill. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.